This episode is brought to you by Dispatch in Depth, a new podcast from emergency dispatchers. If you like Within the Trenches, you're going to want to check this out. Dispatch in Depth takes you deep into the why and how of emergency dispatching. It's produced by the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch and hosted by Isabel Gardette, the Director of Academics at IAED. Each episode features an interview with experts in the field, including researchers, dispatchers, responders, and public safety officials, who talk about the work they're doing to make emergency dispatching as safe and effective as possible. I've listened to each episode, and they are educational and entertaining. Would you believe the levels of evidence, for example, on CPR protocols can be decided with the help of animal studies? Pig studies led to the new compressions-only CPR protocol that showed better outcomes in pigs. These studies can be compared to humans, but you know what? I don't want to give any more away. It's something you're going to have to listen to. It was definitely intriguing and fascinating to listen to this part because it's something that I used when I was in dispatch myself. This episode is called Cardiac Arrested Development, just one of the many great episodes of Dispatch in Depth available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and SoundCloud. And now for the show.
This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning, this episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Good afternoon. This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 158 of Within the Trenches. And this episode is sponsored by Dispatch in Depth, a podcast, a new podcast actually, from the IAED that can be found on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and SoundCloud. This is also supported by InDigital, a leader in next-gen core services. Now, I have to say right off the bat, I'm excited not only for this episode, but I'm excited because I am actually feeling good. I'm feeling, if you've been listening to the podcast or seeing my posts on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram and stuff, you've seen that I've been having some issues with my back, my neck, my shoulder, and you know, the pain has been causing like dizziness, nauseousness. It's just been crazy. But you know, I decided I needed a change, and actually speaking to my guest today in a message on Facebook, she let me in on a little bit of information and, you know, was telling me to stay hydrated. And once she told me this information, I thought, damn, I need to make a change. So I did. You know, I decided to stop drinking for a while. And within just a couple days of that, my back started feeling better. It's crazy to say, it's hard to explain, but it happened. And I actually recently started doing yoga again. So my internal clock gets me up at 6 in the morning. I can go to sleep at 2 or 3 in the morning and my ass will still get up at 6. I have no idea why, but my body is a jerk sometimes. Actually, I take that back. Body, I love you. Don't break down on me. but I started doing yoga again, and it has been really good. I've been feeling way better, more energized, drinking a lot of water, a lot of kombucha, eating salads, a lot of kale chips, stuff that probably doesn't sound good to a lot of people, but I tell you what, it is pretty badass. I like it a lot. So I'm I'm getting healthy. I'm feeling a lot better. And today I turned over my calendar. I've got a friend of mine, a coworker of mine, gave me this calendar of movie quotes, which is awesome because I love movies and I'm always quoting different movies. So I switch over to November 1st, and the quote is from The Shawshank Redemption, one of my favorite movies. And the quote on here is either get busy living or get busy dying. And it just, oh man, it got goosebumps. It's weird that that would be the one to come up as I woke up today thinking I'm feeling way better, did yoga, feeling great. And just, you know, one more step to getting healthy. And then I see that. And yeah, it's true. So, so true. Either get busy living or get busy dying. Thank you, Shawshank Redemption. Also, I've got all kinds of decals that are coming. The Code 7 Dispatch Apparel, the Etsy page. I've been getting so many messages through there, my wife and I, for different states for the dispatch roll call, state roll call decals. Those are coming out, and we've just got a lot of stuff going on, and I couldn't be happier. I love being busy, but you know, things are coming. And also for those who are waiting on other states, please be patient. I've had people who have actually sent me messages and have said, you know, I couldn't wait, so I had somebody else do it. And then I have to ask them not to do that, please, because I have a copyright on it. So please, please be patient. We are working on it as fast as we can. So thank you very, very much for the support. And I love what I'm doing and, you know, the support that you guys give us. So thank you very much. Now, today, my guest today is a person who I actually just found out a few minutes ago that we met a few years ago, and I didn't even put two and two together that my guest today was a person that I met back then, which makes this even more awesome because this is good stuff. We were in an elevator together at the Cal Nina conference a couple years ago, and she saw a t-shirt that I had on. I honestly don't remember the t-shirt it was that I had on. I think it was the Dispatch Love one, where it says love, but the O is actually my logo for my podcast. It's my headset, and she told me right on. And so we had a good laugh right before this started. Though my guest today is Kim Turner, and she's a communications manager for San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department in California. And she's also the president of Kim Turner LLC, a training company. Welcome. Thank you for being on. How's it going?
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you for having me. It's going great.
Excellent. Now, I had been talking to Ryan Dedman, and he's a good friend of mine, and he mentioned you, and we'd been talking a little bit, and like I mentioned just before, just a couple minutes ago before we started recording, I had no idea that that was you in the elevator with me. And I'm sorry, it just makes me laugh that I didn't put two and two together this whole time, especially because I guess I didn't have all the information from Ryan on the fact that you're actually still in the PSAP. I thought that you had left, you know, the public sector for the private sector, but you're actually still in, you're within the trenches still. You're still going strong. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I actually have no plans of leaving. I love my job. I'm super passionate about our industry and what we're doing.
Yeah, and just talking to you earlier, I could tell from it. So let's get started. How did you even get into dispatching to begin with?
Well, like most people, you know, it was completely by accident. I was working my way through college, and a very good friend of mine, we're still good friends, and this is over 30 years ago, he asked me to go with his girlfriend to apply for jobs because he wasn't sure she was actually going to go through and apply for jobs. and we actually were working together, he and I.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like sitting in the car. That's the absolute truth. And she was applying for a dispatch job. And I applied and I got the job. And I was 19 years old. I had no idea what 911 or policing or what any of this madness was all about. And it was before the days of CAD and, you know, we were manual mode, and it fast forward nearly 30 years later, here I am.
Oh man. So you go along and, you know, this is, I have to say this, this reminds me kind of, it was a story that my dad told me, and so this was years ago. This was when, I think it was the Vietnam War was just starting up, and he and three other friends, went to go enlist. And there was one guy who did not want to go, and they were like, "Ah, come on, man, come on, just come with us. You know, it'll be fine." And he didn't want to go and didn't want to go. And he finally, through some peer pressure from all of them, he went with them. And he was the one who didn't want to go was the only one who was able to enlist because the others had like medical issues. Like my father had some jacked up knees. So they wouldn't take him. He couldn't, you know, be on,
you know, on the ground. And so the one who didn't want to go was the only one who got in, and he, you know, he went and came back, and he's actually, he might be a career, you know, military man now, but, you know, he ended up enjoying all of the stuff in the military. So it, I only say that because it's kind of like you, where you were like, well, I don't want to sit in the car, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And then you're the one who ends up getting the job and not the other person. But that's,
isn't that crazy?
Yeah, but it was meant to be, because I mean, 30 years later, you're still doing it. So yeah. What was that like for you in the beginning? So you're 19, you have no experience, right? I mean, did you have anybody in, like, in the military or in law enforcement? No. or nothing at all?
No, I actually, so my friend, we worked at AAA, you know, road service.
Right.
We worked together. So I had no concept of policing, never been exposed to the culture. I didn't have anyone in my family in law enforcement at all, or actually in government services, period. Mm-hmm. And I was naive enough to not understand what I was getting into. And it was before the days of communications training officers. So you sat with a senior dispatcher. We still smoked in the control room. So, you know, there's no windows. Imagine your comm center with people smoking.
Oh, man.
It was odd if you were the person who didn't smoke. All of the ceiling tiles were yellow from the smoke. And just went from there. I was very, very fortunate, though, because I was working for a small agency in a upper middle class neighborhood or city rather. And I was really embraced by the people who trained me, by the agency and the culture, and have some really lifelong relationships and friendships from my first experience. But how I actually ended up on the other side as an officer is that I completely blew a pursuit. And my CTO, we didn't call him then, it was just our trainer, she got pissed at me. Mm-hmm. And she said, get out of my control room. And she had a Lincoln car, which is a one-man car here, come and pick me up and basically go on a ride-along because I completely blew this pursuit, right?
Oh, wow.
Well, nothing ever really happened in this city. It was really a bedroom community, very low crime rate, always on the list of one of the safest cities in America sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, this night, all the stars aligned and we went code 3 so much, the siren went out and I got that adrenaline rush. And I remember turning to the officer and I said, you get paid to do this? And he said, I get paid very well to do this. And from that moment on, I knew I wanted to be a cop.
Oh man, and, get that bug.
But I graduated from college at 20. I wasn't old enough to actually apply. So I started graduate school and I applied later, went to school in Notre Dame. But I came back home because I was actually hired and started my career as a police officer. And I was a police officer and, you know, was very fortunate to be an FTO. Worked detectives as a sex crimes and child abuse detective. But I always was, I was a person who was in love with traffic. I didn't really like to work dope too much, but I love traffic. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I suffered a career ending injury in a motor accident while doing motor training for my agency. And as a detective, I did all of my overtime in dispatch. So I learned CAD. And I was very proficient as a dispatcher. So I never lost my dispatching skills, never knowing I would need it again full time.
Right. So, okay. So the blown pursuit and then the ride along, that's all it took. And
that's all it took. That adrenaline dump is, I think all of us, it doesn't matter what side of the microphone you're on. You're continually chasing the dragon, right?
Yeah.
So once you have that experience, whether that experience is helping a baby being born on the other end of the line, or, you know, being that conduit to get help where help is needed, once you experience that, the physiological response that we have is very much like being under the influence, you know? And
that's true. I've never thought of it like that.
You want to replicate that, and it's all in a good way. It's you're part of the positive parts of society. And, you know, you chase the dragon your whole career. It's good, but it's also bad because it's one of the negative stress outcomes. I know we're going to talk a little bit about that later, but that's one of the issues we have is trying to come down from that.
Yeah, that's very, very true, because I had I had an issue with that as well, where, you know, I'd be on the go like crazy, nonstop in dispatch. And then on my way home, luckily, it was about a 45-minute drive home. But even then, I wasn't calmed down enough, like adrenaline wise, you know, I was still going. So I would get home, and I know I've mentioned this before many times on the podcast, but I would get home and my wife would be talking to me, but I've got dispatch ear going still. So I'm listening to her, but as I'm listening to her, I'm also listening to every single thing that's going on in the house. So the TV's going, I can hear, you know, dinner cooking, or I smell it as well. I can hear the kids playing or fighting, whichever one, and I can hear the neighbors, you know, doing whatever they're doing. And then I snap back to where my wife is at. And she asks, are you listening? And I respond with, yeah, I am. You said this and this and this. And she goes, okay, good. But you're not here. And I'm like, I'm not. I'll be honest with you. I'm not fully here. I heard everything you said, but I am not fully here. So it was hard to break out of that. And you know, even now, still sometimes I will just out of nowhere we'll end up doing it. And she's like, you've been out of dispatch for years. Well, not years. It's been 4 years, but it still happens. So yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
So one of the tips, since folks are listening in our community, I learned this as an officer, is that one of the tips to get out of that and help you build resiliency is before your shift, like if you work out, that's when you want to do your weight training. Don't do cardio. Just do your weight training, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So in my case, back in the day, I used to superset because I hated really going to the gym. So if you spend 25 minutes or 30 minutes just driving your weights, that helps build your anaerobic strength. So, you know, in the case of being in the field, that helps you tackle the bad guys. As for dispatchers, do that as well. But after your shift, if you do 20 minutes of cardio circuit training, mm-hmm. What that does is it allows your body to actually metabolize and burn through all those hormones you secrete through your shift. So it doesn't now get absorbed by your kidneys, your liver, your muscles. You're burning it off. It will allow you to get back into that mind space where you need to be, where you're actually mindful and present with your family and loved ones, and you can leave it behind and decompress as you're driving home. You'll actually sleep really well too. So when I hear people say, oh, I don't have time. Yeah, you know, it's 40 minutes out of your day. And if you have to choose one or the other, choose the cardio after your shift. Just 20 minutes is all it takes.
That's awesome. That's definitely a good tip. And I wish I would have known that back then, because, right? You know, I always had a hard time sleeping as well. And I would get out of my shift because I was a supervisor. So I would work from 4:30 in the afternoon to 4:30 in the morning. And I would get home. And what I would end up doing most of the time is I would get home and I would be the only guy at that time in the morning at the grill, grilling up a T-bone steak and having a cold one for steak and eggs. I would have steak and eggs in the morning. And then after breakfast, oh, it's my favorite. I would crash out, but you know, sometimes I wouldn't. I would just come home because I was exhausted. But then I would lay there, and I would be staring at the ceiling. And then when I finally went to sleep, I would only sleep for about 3.5-4 hours, and then I would be up so that I could spend a little time with my family, and then go into dispatch and work another 12-hour shift. And it was like that all the time.
Yeah, see, that's, unfortunately, that's a reality for most of us. And I just have to tell you, if you work from 16:30 to 04:30, those are like freaking horrible hours, bro. I don't know how you did it.
Yeah.
I mean, 1800 to 06 is bad enough, but my goodness, you had rush hour traffic. I don't know. But part of that is if you did that 20 minutes afterwards, by the time you got home and you took a hot shower and ate a little protein, you would go right to sleep. And you, because you're allowing yourself to not only physically decompress, but mentally as well.
Man.
So if you're listening and you're working those crazy hours, there's a little tips that don't take a lot of time. It's free. If you don't have a gym membership, it's okay. Walk, do something that will get your heart rate up a little bit. And like I say, just 20 minutes is all it takes.
That's awesome. So there you go. For you guys who are listening and those that I used to work with in Allegan that are still working the 4:30 to 4:30 or the 5 to 5, bam, now you know what to do. You'll be able to go to sleep. So you end up becoming a police officer and then you have this injury. So then once you have this injury, had you decided right away after that had happened that you were going to go back to the comp center, or was there any other thoughts of maybe you would be able to rehabilitate and get back in the cruiser, back on the road?
Well, so the answer is all of that combined in the aspect that I fractured my back. I multiple fractures in my arm. I still have a metal plate in my left arm and hand, a couple knee surgeries. I actually suffered a traumatic brain injury. So I actually lost the ability to spell, tie my shoes, all of that. I had to go.
Oh,
I
man.
Had a serious rehabilitation. My accident was in April, April 12th of 2000. I was back to work by November. So I was only out of work for 6 months. I was messed up, Ricardo. I mean, that's the only way I could tell you. Part of having sort of scrambled eggs as brains for a while, the doctors, I had four doctors. I was really fortunate in the city that I worked is that some of the leading orthopedists in the world actually are their home hospital was in the city. And so I had the best doctors I could ever have that put me back together. And they made a collective decision that I would never be able to be out in the field. And I didn't expect it. It was a surprise. And you know, now looking back, it's like, well, how could it have been a surprise? But it really was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really prepared to go back into dispatch. It wasn't something that I thought about. I had just graduated my accident was in January. So the May before that, I graduated with my master's degree in public administration from USC. So go Trojans.
There you go.
My plan was always to actually move over to City Hall. Like my long-term goal was never to be a chief of police, but to be a city manager.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're going through crisis, because that's really what it was, you just sort of make decisions to survive. And for me, what I knew how to do was dispatch, right? That's a skill that once you learn it, it's the hardest job to learn, but the easiest job to do once you get it. I applied at San Jose. One of my best friends who I was radio car partners with had lateral to Northern California. So that's where San Jose process. I passed the background. I had actually applied for a job at City Hall at the exact same time I applied for dispatch, but dispatch picked me up right away and started. You know, but the truth is dispatch saved my life. And I say that because I had suffered a traumatic brain injury and because I had to multitask, mm-hmm. because I had to create new pathways to learn and to retain information, it absolutely was a lifesaver. And for me, a big, huge part of this passion of why I want to help be a part of moving us forward to where we need to be, to call attention to the stress, the psychological, physiological outcomes for what we do from a day to day is because I owe it. I owe it to what we do because it was there for me when I needed it. And I don't know if that translates or resonates with anybody else, but that's a big part of my story, a big part of my resiliency story, and why I'm super passionate about the fact that we really are the first of the first responders, and being able to speak to that from a place of legitimacy, of having been out in the field, having been in the trenches, you know, dealing with the bad guys, having been a detective, and understanding that on the other side of the radio is just as bad, if not worse.
Damn. That is definitely inspiring. To hear you say that, you know, that it saved your life. And I mean, it definitely did, because the way you're talking, you had to find, I mean, you were still, you know, rehabilitating and such, and you had to figure out these different and new ways to do certain things. So because you had to multitask, and I have to say that, you know, dispatchers are probably the best multitaskers out there, you know, working with like 6 screens, 2 keyboards, 3 mice, or however it is, it's amazing. And eat at the same time. I mean, shit, there's so much that can be done at that time. But yeah, it definitely helped to get you, you know, strong and to keep you pushing forward with everything that you were doing. So this is pretty much meant to be for, you know, your calling to do this. So when you went to San Jose, how big was that agency? How much did you cover?
So San Jose is about 100 square miles. They're the third largest city in the state of California and the 10th largest in the nation. They have about 160 dispatchers and there's call takers and dispatchers. So there's 2 separate classifications. And can I give a special shout out to all my call takers in the world? You guys are anchor of every agency. So, you know, stay strong. It's a very large organization, very progressive in terms of training, in terms of legitimizing the role of dispatchers within the organization. And they have a San Jose model of training that is used throughout the entire state, if not the nation. So I landed in a really great place, and they really gave me a solid foundation. And I was a police officer in the city of Inglewood, you know, the Inglewood you hear in all the rap songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, talking about being in the trenches and sort of transitioning and really understanding the role in the field and being able to couple that with my dispatch background, it made me a better cop, but my policing experience made me a better dispatcher in the sense of being able to connect the pieces and really understanding intellectually what our role is, right? And I think sometimes we get a little lost in that, I think from the dispatch side and from the field side, but really understanding that we are vital to outcomes in the field. And it's not about ego. It's about being the best part of support services you can be. And that doesn't mean that you're less than. You just have to understand what our role is and that neither one of us would be successful without the other. So I was really blessed to work with San Jose. And that's really where the research started, because I went back to school after I was promoted to a senior dispatcher, which there is a floor supervisor. So I went back to school for another master's degree because I was really fortunate to work in the training unit there. And it sparked the passion of teaching. And I had decided that I wanted to teach at university, but I needed a PhD to do that. But I didn't want a PhD in public administration. That was a bit boring, you know. And going to San Jose State for a master's degree in justice studies is sort of how I landed in doing my thesis in dispatcher stress, because that naivete popped out again. I thought that there would be a lot of research to lend to that when I found out that there was next to none.
Right.
And
yeah.
That was an eye-opening experience for me.
So going back a little bit, you know, before we get into some of the main stressors and such, what do you remember any of your first calls, whether it was right in the beginning when you very first started dispatching or when you went back to dispatching in San Jose?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I don't remember the first call I ever took, but I could tell you one of the first calls when I first started dispatching. So to set the context, there was no CAD. There was no headset. You actually picked up a phone. And there was a boom mic that came out of the Motorola council. Mm-hmm. So I had a call of a burglary in progress. It was a home burglary. And I remember hearing the glass break where the suspect was entering the house, and the RP started screaming on the phone. And I said on the phone out loud, like, oh my God. And I remember that as if it was yesterday. The units actually got the suspect in custody, but that was like the first time I had the realization, like, this is for real. Like, this isn't like just, oh, take a call and send a cop. This is for real. And the other incident from the dispatch perspective that stays with me is, and where I started was at Culver City Police Department, and it's movie studios, it still is. But we only worked two, we did police and fire, and this was before EMD. So there's no PAI or any of that. It's just run cards. Mm-hmm. I was the fire dispatcher that night, and my partner, who was working police, had to go to the restroom. So you just listen to both. Well, there was a robbery that had occurred earlier, and a unit actually got into pursuit. And not only did they get in pursuit, the bad guys were firing rounds at them as they were in pursuit. There was a part of the city where the radios didn't work. Everybody has like the dead spots in their jurisdiction, and that's where the pursuit terminated. But I knew that there were shots fired. I knew this was a big thing. And this happened in just minutes because my partner was in the bathroom through this entire incident. So it's me. And there was a point in the radio traffic where it's just chaos. I couldn't understand anything. And again, you have to understand, this is a mindset of a, I was probably 19, I was still, maybe I was less than, I was off of training, but I'm not sure I was off of probation. So I'm like still 20 years old, still naive mm-hmm. to the world, right? Yeah. And there's a point in the radio traffic where I literally stop and I'm on the air and I call the officer by his first name. And I tell him, I can't understand what you're saying. I need you to take a breath, and I need you to tell me what's going on. And he does. And he tells me, and we end up, you know, it was a large perimeter. We get everybody in custody. But afterwards, when he came down, and, you know, he gives me a hug, because, you know, there's that bonding that happens with dispatchers and officers.
Right, exactly.
Especially if you work in, if you're not centralized dispatch, right? And you know them. And just the fact that, you know, I broke all kinds of training protocol by doing that, calling him by his name and mm-hmm. not really do. But it's what I did in the moment by myself. And it taught me a valuable lesson that I've carried with me my entire career. And that lesson is that not everything we do, we can codify. Not everything we can do, we can write a rule for or create a card for. As long as we are defaulting to what our mission is, we're going to be okay. And that was such an imprint on me and on my career. And I'm still friends with that officer, by the way. And knowing that it was a successful outcome, I guess I've always known from that moment that I wanted to serve and that I was called to serve. And being a public servant is something we should be very proud of. And it's not about how the public likes to spin it for retirements and things like that. It's not about that. It's that we are very special people, and we need to be really proud of what we bring to the table and what we contribute to our community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Yeah, that's definitely something big and something that I've been trying to push as well. And just for people to look at their job as an actual career, because it is a career, but there are a lot of people that, you know, and you hear it all the time, you know, and I've met some people and I've said, you know, so what do you do in your dispatch center? And you know, are you one of the supervisors? Or are you, you know, dispatcher, call taker? And some of them will say, well, I'm just a dispatcher. I'm like, you're not just a dispatcher. It's kind of turning it around for people to realize that they're more than what they're doing. I mean, they're an important part of public safety, and probably one of the most vital parts of public safety, because as we always say, as we keep saying, the first responder, you're the one who's taking that phone call. You're the first one to take that phone call. And as you said earlier, if it wasn't for that person, those out in the road would not get what's going on. So we've got to change that thought of, I'm just here dispatching. This is just what I'm doing. I'm just working. You're not just working. You're doing a vital piece of an emergency phone call.
It's sort of like saying I'm just the gas in the car, right? Or I'm just the oil in the engine.
Right. Yeah.
Really important. Yeah. Try not having either one of those and see how far you go down the street, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really, and I don't profess to know all the answers, but I do know that a big part of getting where we need to be is legitimizing what we do. And also understanding that it is a calling, it is a career. It's not just a job. And we're not just dispatchers. We're an amazing and important part of a vital role in our society.
Exactly. Now, from your time in San Jose, how long did it take for you to make that switch from San Jose to the County Sheriff's Department and become the communications manager there? Did you start at the bottom at the Sheriff's Department, or did you apply for the manager position?
No, actually what happened was my dad passed away unexpectedly and I came back home. I had a life altering moment. I was around the entire family was gathered around his bed in the cardiac care unit. And I had a moment where I looked and I said, why am I 400 miles away from everyone who loves and cares about me? Mm-hmm. 6 weeks later, I started with the Sheriff's Department. I started over as a dispatcher. I took a tremendous pay cut, it was a 46% pay cut.
Wow.
But let me tell you, it was the best decision I've ever made in my entire life. I'm here at home with my family. I'm surrounded by a really positive support system. My mom lives with me. She's fantastic. Being able to spend this time with her is something I'll never, ever be able to get back. And that resonates as a manager, right? So when I lead a staff, or the holidays are important, and I'll give you an example. So yesterday was Halloween. We had family night and dispatch, so people had their kids up and with candy and their costumes. And, hey, if I have the authority to approve it, why wouldn't I? So that
that's awesome.
People are able to enjoy their families. It just puts a whole different paradigm and mind shift for me. So I started over as a dispatcher here. I was very fortunate in that they had a supervisor opening. Those are rare. A supervisor opening within 6 months of me being here. I was able to be promoted. And I worked the floor on graveyard for a year. Our admin assignments rotate every 2 years. So we're a very large department. The training supervisor was due to rotate out. I was able to be selected to go into training because of my background in training, and really given autonomy and empowered to move us where we needed to be in terms of training, offering post classes. And now we have 17 dispatch instructors through various phases of instructor development. Most of them are advanced instructors. A couple of us are master instructors. And we really have a really wonderful presence in our region, in Southern California. We teach all the time. We have a very robust training schedule for the department. And it's really nice to see people flourish and really get in the classroom, because it's dispatchers teaching dispatchers.
Right.
And I could tell you, and I say this without equivocation or hesitation, is that I love the people that I work with. And I go into battle with them anywhere, any place. They're amazing dispatchers. They're amazing professionals. My supervisory staff is phenomenal. They're dialed in. They're professionals. They're really smart, and they handle day-to-day operations in an effective way. And it's just really, truly a blessing to be here.
How big is that region that you cover, and how many dispatchers do you have on at a time there as a sheriff's department?
Well, we are the largest county in the lower 48. We cover 20,000 square miles. We stretch all the way. We actually touch Nevada twice and circle back and border Arizona. So we're very large. We have two dispatch centers, and they are mirrors of each other. We have a total of 160 dispatchers. We have two classifications. Dispatcher ones are call takers. Mm-hmm. Dispatcher twos do radio and call take. Dispatcher threes are leads and are CTOs. And we have supervisors. And so I'm the manager, and right now I'm covering both. So all of those are my direct reports. At any given time, when we combine our centers, we have about no less than 30 to 40 dispatchers working in each center. That number swells on cover shift, so we could have about 20 dispatchers in one center, maybe 16 in another. It's a very robust operation.
It sounds like it, but it also sounds like a lot of people. And I say this because I come from the last PSAP that I worked at, that I finished my dispatch career off in. We would have at the most four people on. I mean, it's a small county, but yeah. and you know, a rural area. But just thinking about that, I'm like, I can't even imagine. Like, I'm trying to picture it in my head, standing up from a cube and looking around and seeing everyone working at one time, but also working together for a common goal. It's amazing. It's just hard for me to imagine a little bit.
You'll have to come out for a visit, Ricardo.
Oh my God. Yeah. I definitely want to get back out there. Kalnina is coming up. So how far is San Diego from your county?
45 minute drive.
Oh man, I'm all about it. So I have to do that.
So one of the things that is really nice about San Bernardino County, and this is a tourism pitch here, right? Where if you were to stand in San Bernardino County, if you go an hour in any direction, you'll either be in Los Angeles, San Diego, in the mountain skiing, or halfway to Vegas. There's nowhere you could be in our county and not have a lot of things to do and have close access to. It doesn't matter if you're in the dirt and dirt biking or railing, or whether you're into skiing or whether you're into surfing, you will be there if you live here.
That's pretty sweet. But that also means that there are tons of people that are there for phone calls that you guys have to take.
We serve. So we're large in terms of mileage, but our population we serve is just over 2 million. Mm-hmm. That's nothing compared to LA, but we're lucky in the sense that much of our area is national forest, the BLM. So every transcontinental train actually comes through our jurisdiction. Wow. At some point. Yeah.
Man.
We're big.
Well, so let's fast forward a little bit. Let's fast forward to 2013, and this I'm looking at a CNN article, but this isn't. I don't believe this is from the day that it actually happened. I'm talking about the Dorner incident, mm-hmm. And so at this time when this happened, you know, back in 2013, you were already the communications manager there in the county?
No, actually, when this happened, I was a newly promoted supervisor here. So I came to San Bernardino Sheriff's Department in June of 2012. I was promoted to supervisor in December of 2012. And Dorner happened February of 2013.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's go through this. And I'm sure a lot of people know, but for those who might not know, you know, even though this, you know, made national news and such, because I had to look it up myself. Like I vaguely remembered it, but once I looked it up and saw it, I thought, I know exactly what this is. But from your perspective, I want you to tell us and the listeners, of course, what exactly happened in this incident that happened back in 2013 in the county.
So Christopher Dorner was a former Los Angeles police officer who basically wanted to exact revenge on those he felt had wronged him in LAPD. And it started in Irvine, which is a city in Orange County, where he murdered the daughter of a captain at LAPD and her fiance. Irvine is a wonderful community with very low crime rate, and they were working the homicide. They put it together, and they did a CLETS message, which is the California Law Enforcement Telecommunication System, which is, you know, how we talk to each other in California. Every state has its version. Mm-hmm. And I was working as a supervisor that night, and I get a call from our neighboring jurisdiction in Riverside County, and they said, "Hey, did you see a CLETS hit?" And I about a former LAPD cop who's wanted for 187, which is murder. And I'm like, "No, I sure didn't. I didn't." And that dispatcher hadn't seen it either. And it was almost time for shift change. I was waiting for my relief. And in the back of my head, this is the truth, I thought, it'd be just my luck that this is legitimate and I don't do anything about it, right? Mm-hmm. So I Googled just LAPD officer wanted for murder, and like the third hit down was this information from Irvine. So I passed it on to my relief, and my relief said, "Everything ends up out here. Thanks for letting me know." And I went on my days off. And the next morning when I woke up, on the news was about where there was a active shooter event. Well, not an active shooter event, but a shooting. And it involved some Riverside or some plainclothes LAPD officers. Mm-hmm. And it had gone to Riverside, and a Riverside officer was killed and his trainee was critically injured. So the 6 degrees of separation here is that the trainee was a former Inglewood officer that had lateral to Riverside. Where the original shooting happened in Corona was only 2 off-ramps from my house. And they had identified the suspect. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, that's the guy that they called about last night."
Right.
And they have the plate, a license plate on the freeway. I'm on my days off though, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm like, "Oh, they'll get him." You know, we never have long events, right? I'm sure that he'll be captured. It was all over the news at this point. Like I say, the freeway signs are up for the plate. I go on about my business. I had an appointment in Orange County that day. And on our way back, on my way back home later in the afternoon, I get a text message notification that we have 2 deputies. They found the vehicle. And I have a deputy that, we had 2 deputies that were injured. So I drop my mom off and I self-report to work, which, you know, we're not supposed to self-report, but that's what you do. And I'm glad I did. And I have my headset and it's all hands on deck. Everybody is working. Everybody's doing everything they can. It was also February and the vehicle was found in the mountains. So there's snow on the ground. It's cold. And we aren't anticipating, at least in dispatch at this point, we aren't anticipating something that's going to last for days. Our mindset is that we're just going to go into our tactical mode and we'll find him and he'll be in custody and that's the end of the day.
Right.
Well, that wasn't. And what we realized, obviously, is one of our officers, Jeremiah McKay, was one of our deputies, was mortally wounded. And our other officer, Alec Collins, was critically injured. So that changes the atmosphere and the temperature, because like any other communication centers, you know, we understand what our mission is, but these are our deputies, right? And for me personally, having been a police officer, there was a lot of anger in that someone who'd taken the same oath that I did to protect turned against his own, basically.
Right.
But our, like I told you, I said before, our department is extremely progressive. So our dispatchers were a part of debriefing immediately. We were never excluded from debriefing with deputies. We just don't operate that way, and I'm really thankful for that, because from the top down, from the sheriff down, they get it, and we are very much a part of the team. But fast forward to several days later, and we were able to, you know, the situation was resolved, and the suspect, you know, he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. But dealing with the stress from that, and not, it didn't really hit me at the time, right? So it was much later, it was several months later, when I realized that this event affected me, because I didn't get it. I compartmentalized it from all the things that I'd gone through in my career. And I wasn't the dispatcher on the channel. I wasn't the call taker who took the call. That wasn't me. And I think naively, I thought that it wouldn't have any effect on me, but it did. And understanding why, and why, what I was angry about, and what I was upset about, and calling attention to that and dealing with it. So you can use that energy in a positive way to not only be better, but to help other people being better by being honest about your feelings and how you process those things.
See, and that's awesome that you say that, you know, your department included dispatch as well, because there are many people that I've spoken to, and I have dealt with it myself when I was dispatching still, where we had some, you know, some pretty serious incidents where we were not involved. And the one time that I can remember, at least, that I was involved in for a debriefing, they sent someone who, you know, he was a counselor, and I'm sure he did great, and he does a good job and stuff, but he didn't come from public safety. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't really understand. You know, it was more or less, you know, how are you feeling about this? And then would mention it and then say a few things about the call. And then the person would be sitting there like, I have no idea what to say to you. You know, and he would try to understand and let us know why we're feeling this way. But he couldn't. He didn't know what to say. But then there was another time where it was a gentleman. And shout out to Matt. You know who you are. He came in, and you know he works at a dispatch center north of us, or of my old PSAP. And he came in, and he actually didn't say a word at the beginning. He just kind of said hello and walked around, just kind of observed, and then just kind of asked a couple of questions. He knew that we were working our asses off during that shift, and that, you know, not to jump in right away. It wasn't until afterwards that he kind of went person to person and just said a few things, but he comes from dispatch. So he kind of knew how to handle it better than the other person. So again, that is amazing that you guys, involve your dispatchers in the debriefing, 'cause not many do.
Yeah. And it's not just for, you know, a national event. Our dispatchers are always invited. It's never a contention. We also are very fortunate in that we have a very robust peer support program in our department, of which dispatchers are also members. We work with the counseling team, which, you know, the work they do there is a national standard in terms of peer support. Mm-hmm. So we have tremendous resources in our county, and it's never... I mean, I honestly can tell you, I have never had the experience, whether as a dispatcher, a supervisor, or as a manager, where someone said, no, dispatch is not included. It's the opposite. We're always included. And I just feel so blessed, because I know that that's not the norm.
Yeah, definitely. There definitely needs to be more of that. And I'm sure it's probably more, you know, prevalent now. But, you know, back when, and this is just 4 years ago when I was in dispatch, wow. You know, a lot of that stuff really wasn't going on, but I'm sure a lot of it has changed now that, you know, the dispatch has really been put out in the light with their job and what they do on a daily basis and the types of calls that they take and the stress that comes from that. And building onto that and kind of segueing into another incident that, you know, that you dealt with. This is now, let's see, this would be 2015. And this was in your county, San Bernardino County. And I'm going to play a video here really quick. It's only about a minute long for those who are listening, just to hear a little bit about this. This was the terrorist attack incident that happened back in 2015. And there was about 14 people that were killed in a shooting. So I'm just going to play this video really quick, and then we'll kind of talk about what happened, you know, what things were like for you and your crew that was working during that time. So
it is not a safe area to be. It's very dangerous.
We were all supposed to get back into our office and find the inspection. We were able to lock the door.
So we stayed there until the SWAT teams came in and evacuated us.
Large armed response here by the Sheriff's Department.
We do not have any identification on who those suspects are. We do not know what the motive is for the shooting at this point.
You can see tactical teams moving up the sidewalk, looking for positions of advantage right now.
Right now we have one down outside the car, one down inside the car.
Several dozen police officers surrounding the area.
We have agents on a house in Redlands, California right now.
So that video actually is just kind of a timeline that talking about everything that happened there, and I'll make sure to post this up on the blog post that goes along with that. So kind of take me through what happened during that time back in 2015 with this this attack that happened.
Well, as luck would have it, that day we were doing dispatch applicant interviews at headquarters, and because we're a large agency, you know, we normally have a very large list of applicants. So these are the folks who've passed the first phase of the written exam, right? So we had four teams of two dispatch supervisors. I was still a supervisor that were doing interviews. So we're in business attire, and that part's important for a little bit later in the story. But like all good dispatchers, before we started our day, we decided where we were going to go have lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked the place that we were going to go, which would have taken us right by the Inland Regional Center. We picked the time because we wanted to beat the lunch rush. So our plan was to reconvene in the lobby at 10:45 and go to lunch and be there at 11 when the restaurants opened, because it's in the city center. And, you know, it's kind of hard to get a table if you're not there right in the beginning and be on time for our interviews. Well, my partner and I had the luck of having the applicant that just went on and on and on. So we were late leaving for to meet everybody. But where our interview was in the homicide conference room. And when you have that dispatcher ear that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
We could hear like some hand packs going off. We could hear like a patter of feet when they run. And at one point, I remember turning to the other supervisor we're doing the interview with, and we sort of silently acknowledged the fact that something was going on, and it was probably something big, because we knew that the detectives were clearing the station. There wasn't a station page. If there was, I didn't hear it. So when we finally leave, after being held hostage by our applicant, basically, because he just wouldn't stop, we were late. And when we went into the lobby, one of the supervisors had a hand pack, and he says, "Hey, San Bernardino has an active shooter. It's right down the street on Waterman." And we were kind of like, okay, it's an active shooter, like no big deal. And we decided to go somewhere else for lunch. So when we walked to the restaurant, not walk, when we drove to the restaurant and walked in, the waitress said to us, what happened? Because the restaurant is empty, because where we went is where a lot of cops go to eat.
Right.
And we were like, oh, it's an actor shooter. And the waitress was like, oh, no big deal. Because it's San Bernardino, it's Southern California. It's just, okay, it'll be over in a couple minutes. We become numb to this, right? That's unfortunately where our society is. By the time we order and look on the TV, CNN has it up. And we're listening to the radio traffic and we realize this is a big deal.
Yeah.
And we went into straight dispatch mode. And that dispatch mode was, we need to call the applicants. We're canceling the afternoon. We need to eat because we don't know when we're going to eat again. We don't know when we're going home. We go back to headquarters to get, we have to get our gear. Well, by this whole time lapse between us leaving, us going to the restaurant is what, maybe 7 minutes. This is not a long time. It's like 5 to 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. We go back to headquarters, but when we make it back to headquarters, our station is closed. We have two deputies posted. Where the active shooter event happened in headquarters is about a mile. You can walk there. It's maybe a mile from where headquarters is.
Jeez.
We have to get our gear so we can leave. So I'm sort of saying, okay, everybody report back. We've canceled the interviews. We're going to go back to work. Where I parked, I carpooled with the other supervisor, and where we parked at headquarters, we had to walk past the operations center. The operations center was stood up. So to get a better perspective, it's a county building in city jurisdiction, okay? Mm-hmm. So the deputy chief at the time was our forward captain in dispatch. He recognized us and he shouts across the floor, hey, there are two of my dispatchers right there. Come over here. And he goes, I'm going to put you guys to work in the operations center. I need you to help with the phones. So we repaired with two detectives in our Amber Alert Room, which has a mobile command cat. So we were able to fill in calls and create calls to get to follow tips and leads. And that was something that was not by design, but it was one of those accidents where you realize, why didn't we think of this years ago?
Right.
Because who better to manage CAD besides dispatchers? But the funny part about this whole, if there is anything that's funny, is that we were in business attire and we're in a very large department. So the detectives didn't know we were from dispatch. They thought we were detectives from another station.
Oh, wow.
So we were, you know, about a couple minutes into it when we're setting stuff up and navigating around the computer. So with ease, one of the detectives kind of looked and said, hey, you know, what's up? Why do you know how to do that so good? And my colleague says, oh, hey, bro, we're from dispatch. And he was like, oh, I have nothing to worry about now. And it was just kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
So we were able to be instrumental in that aspect of really look at things from a different perspective, from the operations center perspective. Now, as a cop, I never was in an operations center because I was a cop or a detective. I wasn't assigned to intelligence. So it was a really unique experience and one that we later in the after action report was like, hey, you know, maybe we could better utilize dispatch, which really turned into the seedlings of developing a real-time crime center. Where instead of having analysts, because we have centralized dispatch, so instead of having analysts go remotely to dispatch, bring the dispatchers to intelligence. So that's one of the things where we're actually roundtabling right now and trying to, A, can we afford to do it? B, what would this look like? And really sort of reversing how many smaller agencies are doing real-time crime centers. But I absolutely have an expectation that that's where we're going in the future. I can't give you a timeline, but I know that that's where I would like to see us go, where we can really use the skills that we do every day to support intel, support from a different perspective.
So you were pretty much doing kind of like tactical dispatching then at this point with the officers that were in there.
So what's really funny is that at San Jose, I was a member of the tactical dispatch team.
And it's different?
Yeah. So putting that all together, and that's actually one of the projects we're working on here now, is building a tactical dispatch team here in our jurisdiction. So unlike other urban centers, our real challenge here is covering our vast geography. And what that will look like here, I can't tell you yet, but I can tell you is that one of our goals is to move towards tactical dispatch. We may, I really don't want to speak prematurely, but I don't know if we'll have a team that actually responds out with a scribe, or if we'll have a team that runs it from operations. That we haven't vet it yet, but absolutely our department is seriously taking a look at if that's something we will be able to do.
That's awesome. Now, because I can, that type of dispatching helps out a lot. I've spoken to a lot of dispatchers who do tactical dispatching, and it's something that I wanted to try to do when I was in dispatch, but we didn't have a team or anything like that. And I think they were looking at doing something towards the end when I was leaving, and then I left, so I didn't get a chance to do it. But going back a little bit into this incident, so you're with some other detectives and you're taking phone calls and such, but what about the crew that was working on the floor? I mean, from what you can remember, you know, listening to traffic and everything, and those that you spoke to, what was it like in that room for them as this is going on? Because you've got two people who, or at least one of them for sure, that had gone on this shooting spree. And I mean, 14 people, you know, died, and then, you know, the both of them ended up getting killed as well. But what was that like? Do you remember what it was like for them going through that, who were on the floor?
Yeah. So part of that was that a lot of the calls for 911 came into San Bernardino City Police Department, because it's a county building in city jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And I've actually interviewed the primary dispatcher. She's the case study in how you handle these critical events. She was amazing and phenomenal, and really thinking outside of the box. The dispatchers in the county also had a tremendous influx of calls, because people were calling us, and it was controlled chaos. And our primary, one of our primary channels that handles that area, our dispatcher also, because it's our SWAT teams responding, it's our deputies that are responding, were very much involved in that incident, and it was controlled chaos. And I can tell you, matter-of-factly, and having lots of conversations with people, is that we learned a lot of lessons from the response from Christopher Dorner. And people very much were prepared, whether it was experience or training or a combination of both, and they did phenomenal jobs. Like, there's one dispatcher particular with the Sheriff's Department that the work that she did in calling people and managing multiple RPs, getting the information, was just, it's mind blowing how professional staff is, and being able to handle that huge influx of calls to supervisors. So one of the things that the supervisors, we only have one supervisor on the floor at a time. We don't have enough supervisors. We aren't budgeted for enough. So having one supervisor able to manage all of the people on the floor, the influx of calls, the demands from the field, is just phenomenal. And it really was controlled chaos. The other part that's a unique paradigm shift for us nationally is watching the event you're working unfold live on television in your comm center. So that was happening with us as well. And having those conversations about that, because then you become mindful, right? You know, we have to not operate out of fear. Say what you need to say, send people where you need to send people, and it doesn't matter if the news helicopter is up, because we're all professionals. So watching that fold on live while you're actually calling that event is kind of a mind-blowing thing. But it's something that we've kind of gotten used to. And maybe it's because we're in Southern California, where we have a lot of critical incidents. I think that we rise to the occasion. And And if you're a trainer and you've trained for a long time, you know that there's no such thing actually as rising to the occasion. You default to your best training. And so I think we kind of do a really good job of training up our staff and preparing them as best we can. But yeah, talking to them. The other part is that we had just gone live with Text to 911 in October. This event happened in December. And we didn't receive one text to 911 call that was related to this event. So no victims or anyone did a text to 911. But I know that everyone was prepared, and that was really, okay, are we going to receive text messages in a critical incident, and what is that going to look like? In this case, we didn't. So I don't know if that will be the trend going forward, but I can just speak from experience that it didn't become a factor in this response.
You know, that's very interesting to hear too, because when this happened during this time, the company that I work for, we have a text 911 program. And I remember I was doing just some research and case studies and stuff. And after this had happened, that was one of the things that I thought about, because I had spoken a few years earlier to one of your former coworkers I don't remember if you said she works there still or not, but that was one of the things I wanted to ask, because I knew that you guys were going to be launching Text 911 soon. And I wanted to ask, did anything ever come in during that incident? And you just answered it right now. I just got a smile on my face listening to this, because it was something that I've been wanting to ask for such a long time. And you said it without me even having to ask it. So that is interesting that nobody sent a text to 911, because you probably had a good public education campaign as well, because here in the state of Indiana, text to 911 it's used, but it's not used that much. But I believe that it's because of the public education campaign that they put out, where they have said that text to 911 is just, it's like your last resort. You know, it's the next best thing when voice isn't enough, and it's the text to 911. And that's probably what happened in your situation as well, where people, they know that when they call, they're going to get an actual voice, and it's the best possible scenario. But when you don't have that scenario, when you're at that last resort, that's when you text a 911. So yeah, that's good to hear. And those also that are, you know, in dispatch listening to this episode will know as well that even with an incident such as the one that we were just talking about, they're not going to be overwhelmed. There's a possibility, but because people know the certain reasons, or the specific reasons rather, for using text to 911, it's most likely not going to happen that they're going to get overwhelmed. So that's good to hear.
Well, the other part of that is that, you know, each agency will choose whichever, software integration program is appropriate for them. But in our case, and just like our region's case, we were able to limit the number of text sessions we received from the TCC. Mm-hmm. And we did that on purpose, because we don't want, you know, it's no different than a call. You don't want it to be dropped or missed. And I also don't want to overwhelm my call takers or dispatchers when they're processing this. And it's one of these things, you know, 10 years from now, we may look at this and it may account for a large percentage of how we receive our 911 calls. But right now, the way our customer or the consumer habits are not such that texting to 911 is a muscle memory, is a habit. Just, you know, I'm old enough to remember when we didn't have cell phones. So when we started this technology, it's just a change in consumer behavior.
Right.
Now wireless calls are 80% of how we receive 911 calls.
That's crazy.
I don't know what this will look like 10 or 20 years ago, 20 years from now, but I can tell you very matter-of-factly that on the PSAP side, you know, receiving text messages is no big deal. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there in our community about text to 911. There's a huge, giant fear factor that is completely erroneous. And no one, and I'm talking from all my managers, from manager to manager, anyone who's listening to this, the fact that we deny services to the deaf or hard of hearing community because we're afraid of technology. Shame on you and shame on us if that's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who absolutely need access to the services. And if you could text on your phone, you can handle text to 911 in your PSAP. And the other part of it, for all my dispatchers who are listening, once you figure out that you actually don't have to talk to anybody, it's probably the number one most requested assignment.
Right? You know? Yeah, there you go. You know, there's some elements that get taken away, of course, you know, when you know, because when you're on the phone, you're listening to certain things to determine what's going on. So that kind of gets taken away. However, yeah, I mean, that it's so simple to use and such a good, you know, solution, especially for that community, that, you know, why wouldn't you do it? And shoot, I don't know, 10 years from now, we'll probably be using VR headsets and you'll be able to see everything, which would be nuts.
Yeah.
That would be crazy.
It'd be freaking awesome, man.
Yeah, well, like, it would be cool.
I'm not afraid of that. I'm excited about the technology and actually knowing that sitting here talking to you today, what I'll be using 5 years from now hasn't even been invented yet. Like, we're in the middle of the industrial revolution for our profession. That's exciting.
That is exciting, yes. That is definitely exciting, especially with better location accuracy and just stuff that's going to help the people that are calling in for our help, and we'd be able to give it that much better. So looking at these, all of this stuff from the beginning of when you started to becoming an officer, to then going back to the comm center, and then incidents such as these two, the amount of stress and, you know, just the emotions that come with it and everything with this job, is that, you know, kind of segueing a little bit here, is that kind of what inspired you to start, you know, Kim Turner LLC, your training company?
Well, what inspired me to actually start the training company was a very good friend of mine. And I absolutely have to give a shout out to Jamie Hudson, because
sure,
this Jamie is phenomenal. I love him. He's a good friend of mine, and having a conversation with him and him basically saying, you know, you kind of have an obligation, Kim. You know, training is something that I can't speak for any other state. This is where my career has been. But there's always been a deficit of dispatch training, relevant dispatch training. And him kind of calling to attention the fact that I have a unique background and a unique experience, in that I was a cop, I was a detective, and being able to have that experience and coupled with, you know, my academic background, I have a couple of master's degrees, and managing, putting that all together. And as a manager with leadership experience, he's kind of like, it's kind of on you to help the community, like it is on him. Mm-hmm. Because Jamie is a phenomenal trainer, right? So it's not ego driven. It's absolutely to fill a gap in what agencies are able to provide. And we have a lot of small agencies who can't necessarily travel their personnel. And it's not about money, Ricardo. It's about delivering the best training possible in our community to lift us up so that we can actually be better and to drink in that training and learn from each other. We're our own best resources. So that's really how the company was founded. And like I was telling you earlier, I kind of wish I was creative and I could have thought of a cool name, but I couldn't figure anything out, and everybody knows my name. So that's how the company actually was named Kim Turner LLC.
There you go. No, I like it. I dig it. Now, along with that training, though, you've also started up a foundation, and you're doing some research. And
yeah.
Tell me about this research that you've been doing.
So the research is with when I was telling you about the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department being extremely progressive.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wasn't kidding. They've really allowed me to partner with academics to do a lot of research. Right now, our department has partnered with Dr. Michelle Lilly of Northern Illinois University, and she and Heather Pierce did that groundbreaking research in 2012 correlating PTSD and dispatch. Well, Dr. Lilly is working with our agency, and also Dr. Anna Gomez from Cal Baptist University, and we did a statewide research survey April of this year. So all 454 PSAPs in California were invited to participate. The survey was open during dispatcher week, and we had 833 completed surveys. We're finalizing the research right now, actually the final document. Hopefully it'll be published in an academic journal by the end of the year, if not the beginning of 2018. Dr. Lilly has agreed to replicate the study again next year, but next year we're including fire, because fire dispatchers are really overlooked when it comes to stress correlations. And our department will be working with Dr. Lilly for the first, as far as I know, longitudinal study ever for dispatchers. It's very common on the sworn side where you follow a cohort from the academy and you follow them for years and you take a look at stress outcomes. We're going to actually replicate that on the dispatch side, do a pilot study for a year. And the goal is to be able to then do a 3-year study where we take a look at dispatchers from the academy or less than 6 months and follow them. And I'm excited about that because that's groundbreaking. That's also where we're able to validate from an academic perspective the things that we know intuitively in terms of stress, how it affects us psychologically, physically, and the different manifestations of that. Obviously, the goal of the research is to understand what's happening. And then putting my manager's hat on, from an organizational perspective, are there things that we can change or control in our organizational operations to mitigate stress for our employees, to help them develop resiliency and have 30-year careers where they're healthy during that career and after that career when they retire? So I can't control what you decide to do as an individual, right? But I can control certain things and take a look at our scheduling, our processes. You talk about technology, how we implement technology. Are we going to have specialized roles? And one of the misnomers is that people can multitask. We absolutely can't multitask. Our brain cannot do more than one thing at a time. But what we can do is shorten the time between tasks, and we label that multitasking. Well, at some point, we are, we only can process so much. So as we include and increase technologies or the things that we can do to mitigate that stress, it's exciting. And it's exciting to be a part of it. It's exciting for my agency to be a part of really doing groundbreaking research.
I want to fast forward time to get to the end so I can read this research, because that is exciting. That I'm all for this kind of stuff, because the whole reason I started this podcast and the blog that I did and all was because I was stressed the hell out. I didn't have you know, other than talking to my coworkers who, you know, didn't always want to talk about certain things either, I had to find a way to get out my stress. And that was by writing. And, it was very therapeutic. So that was good for me. But, people didn't really understand it. And just talking to, other officers or, ones that were on the other shift, the ones that were on my shift, they knew, they understood. But others would be like, man, you're just, talking on the phone, you're just doing this or that. I'm like, no, you have no idea, man. I want you to come and sit next to me when the shit is hitting the fan, and I want you to take phone calls. I want you to take a phone call where it's a medical that you're giving CPR, but you're the only person on phones and other calls are coming in. You've got a domestic with a weapon and you've got a PIA or a personal injury accident going on. Which one are you going to go to? Which one are you going to take? You've got three of them. Which one is the most highest priority at the time? And, they would say, oh, right, I guess not. maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But this is awesome. I mean, this is good stuff. This is stuff that people need to learn about. This is stuff that people need to investigate, need to research on, to, like you said, to solidify that dispatchers are a vital part of public safety, that they are the first responder, to get that, to move into a different classification of, you know, of a worker, of someone who works in public safety. So this is great. I commend you and all those that you're working with. And actually, Dr. Lilly, I had her on the podcast early on. I can't remember what episode it was, but it was very early on. I had her on the podcast and she talked about that study that they did where they were correlating PTSD and dispatching from their, you know, the one they did in 2012. So I'm familiar with that for sure.
She's phenomenal, and I'll tell you how phenomenal she is. She and actually Dr. Gammas both agreed to publish. So the way when you publish in academic journals, you actually have a choice, right? Where you do open source, which means anyone has access and you don't charge a fee, or you charge. And as you know, that's how, you know, professors earn some stipend, right? Is by charging. They both agreed to do it for free. So not only are they working on this project for free, they both agreed to not receive any dividends, any money.
Wow.
We have people who are absolutely committed to the cause and bringing light to the fact that we have a population about, there are about 100,000 dispatchers in the United States. If you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics, we're very small in terms of the work population, but we're very important to our society. And really, they get it. And it's really awesome because she's brilliant. And the fact that she's willing to give of her time to do this work really means a lot. And from the longitudinal study, we have some large agencies that are on board with us that are moving forward because they get it as well. And they've agreed to participate in the longitudinal study. And that's going to really shed a lot of light. It'll be much more rigorous academic research than just the annual study. And for 2018, we're actually going to leave the survey open for the entire month of April to coincide with the Telecommunicators Week. But it give folks an entire month in California to actually take the study. I'm hoping for, hopefully a 50% respondent rate, because the more people who complete the survey, the more we can validate the results. So
well, when that time comes
to hit you up, Ricardo.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, when that time comes, hit me up and I'll help you push the hell out of it.
I appreciate that.
So going into the wrap up of this episode, one, I want the name of your foundation because I don't think we got the name or anything. But also any of your upcoming classes, you know, and where can people find you? Your social media links, website, any of that?
So wait for it. The name of the foundation is the Kim Turner Foundation.
Nice.
I told you, I don't have any creativity. we're building the website, but I made it easy. It's the KTF.com. So King Tom Frank.
There you go.
The foundation website. As far as the website and where to find me, it's thekimturner.com. And you can just put me in. I'm on LinkedIn. And I'm on Twitter, 911 Kim Turner. It's very easy to find. It's Kim Turner LLC on Facebook. I've learned to embrace and appreciate social media, and I have a lot of fun with it. And I'm pretty good at responding and following and tweeting and supporting all the work that's going on out there, because it's about you. It's not about me. It's about you, and it's about all of us as a collective doing such great work and amazing work to get us where we need to be. Some upcoming classes. To be honest with you, one of the most popular classes we have is the Active Shooter class, which I co-teach with, I call him my brother. He's a brother from another mother, my best friend. We've been best friends since the academy, but he's a SWAT team leader. We are able to integrate the perspective from the field and the first responders' response in the field with our work and dispatch. And there's no other course like it at all. And it's phenomenal feedback. It's probably our most requested course, along with critical incidents. And one of the co-facilitators for that is a dispatch tactical team leader. So I'm able to pair our subject matter experts from dispatch, from the field at SWAT response, and they're legitimate instructors recognized in the state, and bring that training to us in dispatch. And it's had some really positive outcomes. The other class that's in my wheelhouse besides that are our wellness classes. We have trauma exposure and stress management. I teach the only class in the state for stress management for supervisors and managers, because our stressors are completely different than the floor. They're real, but they're different. Mm-hmm. We have a wellness course that Ryan teaches. Ryan does the wellness, some of the wellness training, mm-hmm. but we also teach a crisis communications class where we talk a lot about suicidal callers, but also how we as a dispatch community are dealing with dispatchers in crisis and wellness and resiliency. So many of the classes that you see on the KimTurner.com and that we teach from that perspective are not found other places, because they're written by me, and they're taught by subject matter experts. These are the folks that, you know, when the experts need help, that they call. That's who's teaching these courses. And they all are in the trenches. They all have been dispatchers, or they're still working as dispatchers. So perfect. The relevant experience is phenomenal, and I'm really blessed to have them as instructors.
That's awesome. Thank you very, very much for being on this episode. This has been excellent.
You're welcome.
We're going to have to do another episode, because there's so much more. I mean, just talking about that class, to even build a buzz, you know, to get more people to go to that class. I mean, that would be very cool. So we'll have to keep in touch on that one. So for those who are listening, if you have any comments, questions, or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email me, and that's going to be wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, and that's @901podcast. You can also like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this episode has been sponsored by the IAED, their new podcast, Dispatch in Depth. They can be found on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and SoundCloud. It's also supported by InDigital, a leader in next-gen core services. And this episode, along with all the other episodes, can be heard 24/7 on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, and thejabberlog.com. Have a good one, everybody.
You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.